It's Monday, December 1st, 2014, and you're listening to episode 358 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Julia.
My name's Chad.
My name is Pat.
And this is John.
Yeah, look at this, man. We got all kinds of people that haven't been on in a while, like two. Julia and John. So John's been traveling the nation, helping people take advantage of federal assistance.
Secure their proper due as insured workers of the United States.
Right.
And Julia has been dealing with some
stuff.
You can say it. It's heart problems.
Okay, yeah,
Something's going on.
Yeah, Julia's been dealing with some heart problems, which it's hard to explain that right without getting into medical details because it's obviously serious, but it's not quite as serious as you might think it is. So
I'm not going to die.
Probably.
Yes, you will.
Actually, yeah.
We're all going to die.
I'm not going to die from it.
Right. So now that John is finally on the air, we're going to talk about Mortargate. Now, for anyone that's new to the show, I'll give a real quick recap of what Mortargate was. It's a serious.
Yeah, we put gate on the end of it, so you know it's serious.
That's how we make everything serious.
Yes.
Just like Slapgate and Gnarlgate and all the other gates that Fear the Boot is
having. Slapgate. That's my favorite.
Wait, what was Slapgate?
Slapgate was where we had a game where there was this escalating situation and the NPCs were trying to de-escalate it, but there was a robot in the room that was set up to defend a particular woman. And everything was finally calmed down.
I was there for that.
And then Pat Five Finger Pimp slaps her.
Yes, everything went completely off the ranch there. I don't remember that being elevated to a gate, but I remember it happening.
Yeah, oh yeah, it got elevated to a gate later. But, all right, so Mortargate. There's a game that I was running for John and some other folks, not the other hosts. It was some just people from online listener show. Good people, all right, but we were running.
No, they're bad people. They're the rough and tumble rednecks of the role-playing game world.
They're horrible people.
Come on, you gotta spice this story up.
Almost
man.
Canadian.
I think
at least two of them were from New York. They were almost Canadian.
Yeah. So anyway, so during this game, there was a setup where they were on a ship being posed as slaves that are about to be traded off in the kind of the fringes of space. But it was a setup, and so their pods were set to release them mid-flight, at which point they were supposed to take control of the ship, which they successfully did. When they get in system, the ship that they're supposed to be meeting up with, which is the actual bad guy pirates, whatever, that they were supposed to be sold
to
as slaves.
Captain Harlock?
Sure.
Yes. It's not a Chad game, Chad. You can't just jump in and say, this is that guy now. Okay.
Damn it.
but
I do so like it's this. A game.
Exactly.
But their ship gets shot down by another ship. And
the Arcadia?
Yes.
Excellent.
I want to go way back in anime here and start talking about the Ulysses S. Grant. No, it wasn't Ulysses S. Grant. I'm sorry. It was the Greek Ulysses. See how many people remember that anime.
Dan, put a dinosaur in the story.
So when they land on the ground, there's a Stegosaurus.
Yes!
And the Stegosaurus got...
I wish.
His name is Steggy.
Yes!
Steggy.
This is my favorite game.
Steggy was
ever.
Chilling with his friend, Bob the Bronto. And Bob was having an existential crisis over the fact that apparently brontosauruses don't exist.
Yeah, they're so emo.
Right. And there was this really self-righteous Apatosaurus named Pat.
Potty Pat,
who's all arrogant about the fact that he does exist.
Right. Yep.
And the brontosaurus is like, oh, whatever. And then all of a sudden a meteor hits him and they're all dead.
Uh-huh.
And the characters just kind of re-evolve up from there. Okay. Gotcha. So like billions of years later or millions of years later or 6 years later or I don't know.
However, 5 years in the future.
Yes. 5 years later.
The same dinosaurs are in London.
Oh, my.
But they get down there and they get confronted by the pirate crew that they were supposed to be trying to...
Harlock and the Arcadia.
Yes.
Yep.
That they were trying to arrest or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the pirates try to make a power play to get control of the situation and claim that they had heavy weapons set up on the far shore. And as soon as I said this, and this was NPC, this was not GM plot exposition. Mm-hmm. This was one of the NPCs saying it. As soon as the NPC said it, John pretty quickly responded with a rather flustered or annoyed, of course they do. Like
I harumphed.
Yes, you are rumped, as if I had taken away all player agency here and just kind of railroading her. That's how it felt to me. And it's like, come on, dude. You've been playing with me.
Right.
No, my G. It's like, you really think I would do you that way? Okay, so we've been giving this single-sided but completely accurate view of events for about the past couple of months now. So I will now give John an opportunity to give us whatever fictitious spin he has of these events.
I will have to say that I was not in this game. And I still have no idea what's going on. But I do like the addition of Harlock and the dinosaurs and stuff. That's pretty cool.
I didn't add that.
Oh, excellent.
The dinosaurs
were central plot points.
Yeah.
Okay, Dan. Okay. So Mortosaurus. Everything you just said actually happened as you said it. I will not dispute your facts. However, you started in about Act 3 or Act 4 of the 5-act play that led up to this, and I'm going to start at Act 1.
Okay.
Oh, snap.
We had in the immediately preceding campaign with, I believe, all of the same people, sort of got it off the ground, but sort of hadn't. It was the Skies of Glass campaign. It was very low power. Listeners of our show probably know what Skies of Glass is, but in short, it's a post-apocalyptic setting with no voodoo and no mutants that let you shoot lasers. You know, you're pretty much on the run trying to find clean water and not get shot, and that's how we were playing the game, and that was all okay. Well, during the course of the game, we had some constructive conversations and indeed both one-on-one, me and Dan, and within the group, about what was going right, what was going wrong, how to improve it. You know, as Dan and I and many other GMs do, soliciting frank one-on-one feedback as best as you can do it in a group game setting, which is, as we've said before, kind of hard because no one wants to be a dick and say your game sucks. And the game didn't suck. One of the things we had talked about in the course of those conversations was my observation that it really seemed like the PCs were on the ropes constantly, and not just in that sort of adventure conducive, of course they need peril to move the plot kind of way, but the vast majority of the camera time of the game seemed to be, okay, now you're locked up. Okay, now you're hiding under a table because the bad guys are searching the train. Okay, now your town is under siege and you have absolutely no way of beating them in a straight fight. It's time to think of something erratic and go outside the box. Okay, you went outside the box. Now you're at the bad guy camp where you're completely surrounded by bad guys and pleading for your life in front of a court of them. Then we sort of changed the characters around a little bit so that there could be a little more agency, a little more offense on the side of the PCs, and the game collapsed for unrelated reasons. But either way, up to that point, the preceding, I don't know, 8 or 10 weeks of gaming in which we had played for 6 or 7 had been, you're on the run, you're surrounded, you're boned. The RP interaction is the PCs as themselves negotiating with Dan as a very, very clearly superior power how to get to the next step. Going to Epoch of Rhysos, part of the reason we had made that transition was in EOR, you generally are not a tattered hobo that's drinking out of a toilet. You know, you could be, but there's a lot more options than in Skies of Glass for you to be some sort of military commando or mercenary or diplomat or noble or fringer or whatever. Someone who hasn't been thrust into this by falling bombs and who is more or less where they should be with the training and experience and equipment to be effective. And most of us took him up on that chance, and I did myself. I went from playing a rambling, gambling train track hobo to a space marine, basically. And I thought, okay, things are going good. We're laying in wait here. We're going to jump the trap. We jumped the trap. We got it. All right. We blew up out of the cryo chamber. We took the pirates or the smugglers or whatever they were completely by surprise. Some gunfire was exchanged. We took over the ship. Things are going cool. Then the yellow card. A third-party belligerent drops out of hyperspace and cuts our ship in half. Apparently, no real way open for us to fight it back or to even flee. You know, the next part of the plot is the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald going down here to the shores of Lake Michigan Superior. Anyway, the next part of the plot is the shipwreck. Okay. Once again, we've lost to an unbeatable force. This is a new campaign. The plot is moving. We're still doing okay. This is not a red card, but it's a yellow card. You know, the shields for this sort of thing have recharged from zero since the last campaign, but instead of it being full 200%, they're at, you know, a yellow arc of your X-Wing on either side.
I was about to say, I like the X-Wing reference.
Yes, but then, boom, then Mortargate. Then we are approached by the NPCs who once again say, as they have said before in the previous campaign and the start of this one, you are surrounded, you are hopeless, plead with us for your lives, do our bidding, whatever. And it was at that point that I threw up my arms and said, okay, more or less wake me up when we get to the plot point where we actually get to be the heroes and take some effective action and go forward on ourselves. So, Dan, that is ultimately my Mortargate counterpoint, which was in a vacuum, and even perhaps from the start of that game, the events of Mortargate were nothing out of the line and nothing catastrophic. But as the seventh out of eight pitch in a row wherein the PCs were or appeared to be hopelessly beleaguered, after a separate conversation about how that was getting really boring and repetitive for us, I got frustrated.
Yeah, and here's the lesson that I think I draw from this as a game master.
Don't game with John.
Yeah.
Screw you.
I need puppets and dinosaurs. No, it's as much as we talk about how you ought to look at things in character and in the context of the game. Obviously, the inescapable reality of role-playing games is it is a social hobby done between human beings who, of course, are going to have these metagame perspectives of the events. When I talked about how Mortargate kind of befuddled me, one of the things that I kept coming back to is, you know, as a GM or as a friend, I would hope that John would know that I'm not going to do him like that. You know, that's not my way of doing things. But in a way, I think kind of what John has done here is demonstrated that that's exactly what was going on. That because of the fact that in the prior campaign, it was not my goal to run them around on the ropes all the time. But I think there was some misunderstanding between the GM and the players about what this kind of game is like. I don't think John had ever played Skies of Glass before. In fact, I don't think anyone.
Not for any more than a little one shot or two.
Yeah, so I don't think anyone on there had ever played Skies of Glass before. And so when the characters were created, there was nothing per se wrong with the characters, but they really weren't per se good at a particular function. It wasn't like the game, for example, that Chad I did with you and Pat and Wayne and Dave, where you guys, okay, you had your side skills, but you all understood you were wannabe mercenaries. So you had those abilities and those inclinations. Their group was much more scattered and random. And so as a result, in many situations, they lacked the focus to really effectively deal with the situation by any means, socially, militarily, subterfuge and escape, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't blame anyone for that. I think it was just growing pains of a new group, a new GM to this group, and a new game. And so by the time we get to the Epoch of Rysos game, I think in many ways, John is doing the exact thing that throughout our prior discussions of Mortargate, I had been upset that I felt he wasn't doing, which is he's reading the GM in a metagame fashion. Admittedly, in that situation, the most present thing on his mind, of course, John, you can speak to this for yourself, is probably not going to be what is Dan like as a whole over the course of these, you know, 10 years we've known each other.
Right.
What has Dan been like over the past 10 weeks?
Right. And your incredulous appeal the first time around when I wasn't on the mics was, what the hell, John? I've played in your games. You've played in my games. I don't dick you around like that. And that is true. But it was the short to intermediate prior term of one specific method of dick arounder-y that had reduced the shields and got me to the point where I was ready to check out.
Are you ready for me to pass judgment on both of you?
You know, I was going to give sort of a little kind of bow tie bit of advice here, which I will still do. But first, go ahead, Chad. Judge us. Judge me for my clopper ways.
That's a separate case that's still pending.
Yeah.
So I can't speak to that one. That's in a different court. So
I was talking to Brodor about that earlier. So we'll bring him up for that.
A lot of the details that have been bandied about this, whatever gate we're on, I really haven't been listening. I really don't know what the hell you're talking about. I wasn't there and I don't care. Oh.
Sounds like you're perfectly qualified for the judiciary.
Yeah. To be honest with you, what this reminds me of, the couple of bits that have actually kind of pierced my daydreaming and imagination as I've been sitting here. I remember we did an episode a while back where we talked about taking prisoners. There's a plot, there's guards, whatever. It doesn't matter what the trappings of it is. And then there's the players, and the GM has an idea for a story where he's like, I want to throw the players in jail. You know, maybe it's a Man the Iron Mask sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I got to throw them in the jail because that's where the real prince is. And he's in there, man. It'll be all kind of cool. And then they can escape. It'll be an adventure and they'll kill a bunch of guards and then they'll save the kingdom. And it'll be so awesome. But to get there, I got to have the whole town guards who are basically the Keystone Cops compared to actual intelligent thinking players. I have to have them capture them. So we talked about a lot of different ways to do it and a lot of different ways not to do it. What makes me think of this is like when John was saying, you know, they had this big space battle and then Harlock and the Arcadia came in and cleaved their ship in half. And that's where they started the second plot, or, you know, that they were taken prisoner or in this one game, or they were kind of had the wool pulled over their eyes in the border thing. Again, I'm really fuzzy on the details. What got me thinking about that is basically what you're doing is you're essentially taking them prisoner. In a metaphoric way, like what we talked about on this episode, you want to be big damn heroes. And big damn heroes don't get taken out by the Keystone Cops. But to tell a really good story, sometimes players have to allow themselves to be taken prisoner. And there has to be, I think, a level of communication on that. There's a lot of people who play role-playing games who are like, well, that works in a story like a book or a movie, but the whole point of the role-playing game is the horror analogy of you don't play the dumb blonde who opens up the door. You play the guy who kicks open the door and blasts the werewolf or walks away or has 1,000 other options that they can do.
Right.
And that's the joy of the role-playing game. So I'll explain all these other options. And I think while that's true, I think that there are other ways of role-playing. And I think that you can communicate as a GM with the players, and I think the players need to be open and saying, hey, guys, I got this idea where the ship's going to blow up, or I got this idea where you get tossed in the can, and then that's where the plot's going to start. It's just really anathema to people to have the GM say that and tell them, is it okay if your team takes a fall? And people are really against that. It is immersion breaking. And that's kind of what we talked about on the show, is that there really isn't a good way to have that conversation.
No, there isn't. But
well, I think it depends on the game, too. I feel like, John, I see where you're coming from. But in a game like what you're describing, I haven't played either of them. I would expect to kind of get it on a lot. I know that's a bad way of putting it, but it sounds like a game where you're not supposed to be winning all the time.
I really tire of games like D&D traditionally ran, where it's win after win after win after win. And I tire of that. And when that starts happening, I start programming in failure into my character.
Yeah, I used that thought for a second, because that's going to be, if we get to the other topic for today's show. But I think something else that had not helped leading up to this was Skies of Glass is meant to be a game that's about hope in the face of desperation. Mm-hmm. That's already kind of the intended feel of the game. But I think that got magnified by the fact that when the players were creating characters for it, once again, not exactly understanding how the game works. I've talked about before how I like players to give me background hooks I can use for their characters. And most of the background hooks I got was pretty serious stuff. But the party as a whole really was not qualified to be taking on that kind of stuff. You know, they just didn't have the skill set to really function on that level as a team of people with skills that either complement each other or work together to make them all good at the same thing. And so what happened was they were taking on threats that were really in many ways out of their league, but had creative solutions. But this led to the other problem of the fact that I think, for example, if I was to run this for you guys, I think you would have pulled through better because of the fact that you guys know each other better You as players know how to synergize
better.
They had
a lot of things going against them.
Right.
Now, Dan, I'm going to point something out to you that you may not realize. Think back to our discussion on the three clue rule advice, where you give Hook's ideas and clues, and you think that they are very, I want to say you think they're very obvious, but that's not correct. You make them very subtle. And if you have the wrong kind of group, that group flies right over them and there's problems.
Yes.
So maybe that's what happened here as
yes,
well.
And I have no doubt that is part of what happened is to solve these plot points with the characters they had. It was going to require a lot of creative problem solving. And I don't think the players were familiar enough with each other or with my GMing style to recognize those opportunities as they occurred. And so I don't per se think there is fault on anyone or perhaps.
I'll tell you who's at fault. I am judging everyone. Mm-hmm. So I am the arbiter of who's fault.
All right. Fair enough. But Your Honor, it is my view of things for the court to consider that I think it is a situation best evaluated as either no one was at fault or everyone was unwittingly at fault. But John, now with that perspective, because when I looked at that campaign, I was looking at it purely in the context of that campaign plus years of prior knowledge. I really had not taken into account. It was very fair of you to bring that up. The more immediate context of the campaign that we had just shut down to attempt to sort of regather and reconstitute around the Epoch game. And so I fully admit, I don't think I was even thinking about, forget failed to read, I don't think I was even thinking about how are the players approaching this coming off of that campaign. To me, it was a clean slate, which admittedly is the guy who's writing the game seems reasonable, but it's not fair to expect the players to somehow magically know what my intentions as a GM are.
You should listen to Fear the Boot. We got this great episode on Three Clue Rule.
I'm going to have to check that out. I hear that show recommended a lot on the show.
Yes.
I'm going to have to check that out.
That's pretty dumb. They don't have a soundboard.
I shall pass judgment now. I believe that Dan is guilty of what we talked about, being too specific in the clues, I guess you could call them, or the cues.
Cues, I think, is better than clues. But yes.
The cues. Your sentence is to review the Three Clue Rule episode
where
we gave you that advice. I think that the players are guilty, culpable in this, for playing EOR and Skies of Glass. It is a new group with new players, and EOR and SOG are advanced games. You should play something simpler. Play a fantasy game. Play Shadowrun. Play something like that.
You can do something similar to Shadowrun.
Everybody knows going in what the language and the tone of the game is at the start.
Right.
Then you get comfortable with each other. And don't make this a three-year-long epic campaign.
Sure.
Make it a story arc. And this is me not... I'm looking at you as I tell you this. This is not me saying that this is your son. This is the group's... my judgment upon the group.
This is what all of us will be doing in Siberia.
Yes. In the gulag... You guys need to play a more toned down game with an established setting, an established tone, and not D&D because that has an interpretive tone, but something like Shadowrun or Werewolf or whatever. Something with an established tone that everybody knows what the rules. Star Trek, the perfect game. Everybody knows how Star Trek works.
Then
I got to say, side note here, but I think still a relevant piece of advice. Is I have actually found that Star Trek is a better introductory game than D&D.
Yes.
Because within the role-playing community, D&D is a ubiquitous game.
Right.
I would wager damn near every gamer out there has played D&D or some variation thereof at some point in their career. But when you go to someone who's never touched a role-playing game before in their life, sure, they've heard of D&D. They have all these preconceptions of what it is, but they are far more likely to know Star Wars or Star Trek as an intellectual property than they are to know D&D or the writings of Tolkien it was based on. And so I have found that Star Trek or Star Wars, my preferred flavor of Star Trek, is a much better entryway.
Either one would work.
Yeah, when I was starting that group with my family, they did not have any idea what a lich was or what a schools of magic, arcane versus divine.
Here comes a rust monster.
What's
a monster made of rust?
But they understood what a Klingon was.
Yeah.
You know, they got that. Okay, they didn't know all the minutiae of Star Trek. They didn't have memory alpha memorized, but they got, you know,
amateurs.
But, you know, if I said
fake nerds,
if I said transporter or phaser, they knew what I was talking about. Absolutely. I mean, these are cultural, you know, mainstays. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's move from this into another topic that is at least tangentially related. John, do you want to give the thesis here or do you want me to give it?
Sure. I'll give the thesis. So everyone's afraid of Ebola. But it's actually not killing that many people, at least here in the Western world. Nobody is afraid of the flu or COPD or driving their car
Spanish
or heart
influenza.
Attacks. But those kill lots of people.
Yeah, whatever Julia has.
Yeah, whatever Julia has.
She's actually in a bubble right now.
Yes, yes.
She's recording in a bubble.
Yeah, that's why I'm recording this from Colorado.
John's the smart one.
It's called my heart herpes.
Yes.
Yes. She gave me herpes earlier.
Anyway, what this has to do with RPGs is everyone is really, really afraid of death killer GMs who won't pull their punches and make it really boring and take away your player character by killing them with a high roll and all this crap. But it seems to me that out there in the wild these days, there's not really a whole lot of that going on, at least in long form campaigns.
Yeah, and I want to pause you on that one because I know there's a second part to this and just say that I completely agree. And when you posted that in our discussion area for these shows, I stopped and thought for a minute because I'm one of those people that I have this fear of killer GMs
and Ebola
and Ebola and Julia's heart herpes and, you know, or even just GMs that are intrude heavily upon the golden box. But the thing is, as I sat there and thought
break the golden box,
it's like, no, but it's like how many GMs outside of con games, which are a unique bird. Because they're kind of meant to crash and burn for comedy value.
Well, and you don't really have a character you care about.
Right.
That.
Yeah. I mean, and even if you do, once again, it's 3-4 hours, you're done. But how many games or game masters have I been around?
Or master game masters.
Or master game. Yeah, exactly. Where this was really a honest, reasonable concern to have. And the answer is not freaking many.
Just John.
No, even John. I mean, look, I give John mad props as the only time in a role-playing game my character's been killed and I feel completely above the table and legit. It was not this, like, murder fest. It was not like, oh, whoops, you went left instead of right, rocks fall and you're dead. He did not pull some BS like that. You know, it was all straight by the book, above the table. And even after it happened, he gave me a chance to say, okay, do you want to retcon this? You know, John is the only person legitimately kill one of my characters in my gaming career, but that's kind of the point.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I'm afraid of a boogeyman that really, in truth, I've never encountered, or I guess more accurately, have not often encountered. Yes, I have run into jackass GMs or good GMs who are just being a jackass on an off day.
Your former abusive boyfriend group.
Well, and even going back farther than that, the first character I ever had killed was the one that I got screwed out of, and you were in this game because the GM kept adjusting the hit points of the enemy because he didn't like the fact that I'd killed his Baron von Badass.
But you can't complain about that because when we confronted him about it, he copped to it. He admitted to it. I don't know if he apologized or not, but he...
Oh, I still had to make a new character.
Sorry.
Julia,
we're getting a little tangential here, guys.
Right. So, the point being, it seems to be a fear that has more to do with popular perception than it does with the reality of what gamers are encountering, at least in my experience. John, continue.
Yes, and in my experience, and the experience of many people I've talked to this about. That's the Ebola. Let's talk about the heart disease. The heart disease is GM's who will not kill you no matter what the hell you do.
Or possibly even inflict any meaningful consequences on you.
Exactly.
Shy of death.
The ladder of everything has to win all the time that Chad so dreaded experiencing, which I also hate from a GM and a PC perspective, is the danger that's actually out there because everyone is so afraid of being part of or being seen as a killer GM death group, that they get to the point where they've sacrificed the illusion of danger, if not, of course, the danger itself. I'll settle for the illusion of danger. It's usually all you can get, although, as my detractors and PCs will tell, I actually provide real danger in my games. I am far more afraid, and I think you, the listener, should be far more afraid of playing in a game where you're going to realize that you're in that casino in the Twilight Zone where you can never lose, and that's actually hell instead of heaven. When the crap goes down and the dice are all going your way, everything is nice and the illusion appears to be holding up. But if you test at the borders a little bit, you start rolling really bad for a really long time, and you tend to realize that the GM is starting to declare that all of his actions are missing and all of your checks are succeeding. And even though you lost your butt, you actually won if you count the fact that this dude showed up or that thing happened, or, you know, in the final breath of the combat, these two NPCs started attacking each other so that you could win. And I don't have a particular game or GM to indict on this, other than, you know, broadly, the general experience I've had as a PC for the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, the D20 era onwards, certainly my adult life insofar as you consider such a thing, starting around the time the D20 came out, there's a whole lot of games I've sat in bored because I realize I can't lose, and there's a whole little, read zero, games that I've sat in where I've not been the GM, where I felt that PCs were dying unfairly or that I was even at risk of being killed unfairly. Discuss. Is your perception of the situation the same as mine or not?
Yes. Let me make a very brief aside and then get to your more specific point. The very brief aside is, this is one of the reasons that I love Battletech, because of the fact that with the mechs and equipment and finances, there's a way in which the party can pay real consequences without me having to go all the way to actually wiping out the party. Or, you know, you could have a mech TPK without the actual characters having a TPK. Mm-hmm. And that was something, yes, John, I hope I did pretty fairly, was, you know, your group could suffer meaningful loss and setback, and I was keeping an above-the-board
stretch. No, you did great. You killed Wayne. I had absolutely no problems with that campaign. I loved that Battletech campaign, and I was pissed when it ended.
But
so, okay. I will give you credit for that.
All right, fair enough. And maybe one of these days again, I'll start up a Battletech campaign. But in the interim, here's the point. There is no such thing as courage if there is no fear. Someone who fears nothing is either all-powerful or insane. They are not courageous. Courage is when you actually face a real threat and muscle through it anyway. And I think we can say this of any human virtue. A human virtue exists because of the fact that its opposite exists and exists powerfully. I mean, even let's take very simple things. I would not know the significance of light if I had not experienced darkness. But my point is just that there is no meaningful success. There is no meaningful moment of overcoming if there is not the real possibility of failing in some way. And I have never been a proponent of rapid fire murder of the PCs because of the fact that I found it tends to always lead to bad things, like people just putting less and less investment into the characters they create because they feel they're too disposable. But John, I absolutely agree that games have in many ways gone to the opposite extreme, where success or success with trivial cost in the grand scheme of things is so common that in truth, it probably does more harm to the narrative in terms of the games the average person's playing than player character death has done, certainly within recent years. I don't know, maybe back in the 70s, 80s, whatever, maybe this was a bigger thing. But as of the state of gaming right now, this really just plain doesn't seem to be the widespread
issue.
And
I think that's a good point. I think we're shell-shocked from the material that came out in the 70s and 80s, and we're still not over it.
Yeah, I mean, Tomb of Horrors. I mean, that thing was, of course, a unique specimen. It didn't exist in a vacuum. You know, it was not the only killer module out there. And yeah, there was this very prevailing idea about the hostility between the players and the GM that was just supposed to be, quote unquote, part of the fun. And for people trying to build deeper characters, it's not part of the fun.
You know, it's just not something that bothers me, because in the games that I play, challenge that my character runs into is not necessarily a challenge that would kill him, whether you have a group or party that does character, I was about to say player death, does character death or not. I don't think that there's this false success and a false failure when you have a group that doesn't do character death. Unless your group and the game you're playing has a lot of combat in it. If you have a lot of combat or traps or things that will kill your character...
Yeah, your character's going to die.
Then yeah, you know, if there's no character death, then yeah, that the majority of those challenges do become trivial. But if you're playing a role-playing game that's very plot-heavy and plot-centric, and it's about who's doing what and who's saying what to who, and the characters and the development, and yeah, there can be combat in it, but the combat is not the main thing, then who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't really matter. I'm developing a character and telling a story. I sure as hell don't want a random throw of the dice, an unlucky night, to wipe out my story. I want to choose when my character gets snuffed or not.
So let me tie some of those ideas together with something that you've said many times in the past, which is that one of your concerns with the narratives of many role-playing games is they're really about expanding successes.
Yes.
You have success and then a bigger success and then a bigger success and then a bigger success all the way up to the
inside the rules and outside the rules.
All the way up to the biggest climax of the game where you have your ultimate success and then you kind of have your epilogue where you go off into the you're giving me crazy eyes, Julia.
Her heart's gonna explode. Uh-huh.
Yeah. She was like leaning back and like giving me like big eyes and like
he knew what I was doing.
We were having a moment.
I was waiting for her to like give me some kind of like demonic prophecy or something.
Oh man, her heart was gonna explode with herpes all over the place.
I know, but maybe
thank
like
God she's in the bubble.
She was about
you
to
said climax, and that was
okay. You and Pat got perverted. Exactly. I'm sorry. Yeah. How I honestly don't know why I didn't see that.
I know. I don't get
really fair.
You were it's in the moment. Xanax.
Yeah, I'm
sorry. I didn't mean
it
to throw
you off. Xanax. If you take a game where person to person combat's a real thing, so we're not talking about BattleMech.
Right.
All right. We're talking about Shadowrun, we're talking about...
Well, any game.
In any game where it is human-to-human, person-to-person combat, then just as failure in the puzzle part of the game or the social part of the game needs to be a real threat, in the same way, what's the threat of the outcome of combat? Well, it's going to be one of a couple things. Capture, serious injury, or death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that's very hard to balance because, as I said, you throw away characters too quickly and people stop investing in their characters. I have never met a player who doesn't do that.
Or if you're playing a heavy combat game, this is what I've run into, too, when I've run D&D, is everyone's like, okay, on board. Yes, character death again.
I think there needs to be more player death.
I know, there does.
So does Wayne, apparently.
But the character death, yes, we're all totally fine with character death. Character death is absolutely awesome. It makes the game very real. Okay, we play, we have a combat, and somebody's character dies. Well, then they look at me. This is your fault. Because you didn't balance the encounter correctly. And it's like, didn't balance the counter correctly? That's the same as saying you can't die.
Yeah.
You know, because balancing the encounter correctly means you win.
You win or you die.
Yeah.
I think you do a good job at character death because, and I can't remember the character's name, but the one I started as a paladin in and almost died and I couldn't continue. I mean, didn't you, you brought one of your characters back to life as something else. So.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I did the whole reincarnation gambit.
Which
George,
I think
you could come back, but we're rolling on that percentile table, and I ain't letting you change.
Right, and I think that that
is a wombat.
Wait, which one did you use? Did you use the one from like 2E where you can come back as like a raccoon?
I think there's one in Pathfinder. If there's not, there's one in 3.0 or 3.5. There was some freaky shit, but it's normalized such that you're probably going to come back as something normal, and he came back as a dwarf. But anyway, Julie, you were saying?
Yeah, I just think that's a good approach. I think that when you do kill a character, and I know that you do put a lot of time into your characters, but I was actually just having a conversation with Chad on the way down that I had a GM that had like GM ADD where we would put a ton of time into this character and start this campaign, and like 3 to 4 games in, he wants to switch campaigns. Mm-hmm. So I have a folder full of characters. There's nothing wrong with reusing characters. If you're playing a game and like the paladin that almost died in John's, if she would have died, I would just use her again later. I mean, it doesn't hurt to use these characters again that you're putting all this time into. So don't get butt hurt about it. Mm-hmm. Put them away. Either random roll like John or create a new character, and now you have another one you can put in your folder and use again.
Roll method one, or you're a wimp.
You know, if Wayne were here, he would be all over your shit on that, though, because he's one that is always like, I love making new characters. I think, I may be wrong, Wayne, and I'm sorry if I am, but I don't think Wayne would want to do that. He wouldn't want to play a character again.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying
it's... play it once and then boom, that's it. I won't pick a new character.
It's an option. No, I would much rather make a new character. I'm a new character type of person. But when, like I said, in my heart.
As long as he wears a rubber glove.
Yeah, well, she's in the bubble.
Yeah, that's true.
And then I get to, feel her bun.
They've got the...
Ebola.
No, Ebola.
The hand spots.
Yeah, the hand spot thing that I can't... I'm stroking out again.
But I think that, like I said, I had to create so many and all these games that I really wanted to play these characters in and I never got to. It's the same idea, same concept. If you want to build a new character, great. If not, use one of your old ones.
I got burned on that too because, you know, that's one of the things that I've talked about that before where I really have a problem with putting a whole bunch of time into a character and then to turn around and play like one or two sessions with it and then it's over.
And I
got burned to the point where I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to put in
100%
six to 12 hours worth of work on a character to just have it.
12 hours?
No, I've seen
a couple sessions. We do a couple, maybe a couple sessions of work on a character.
And I've seen Pat
to get it not be played.
And I've seen Pat make a character for it. Pat and I make characters in very different ways. I'm an idea guy, and my ideas are pop, 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 done. And so when I make a character, it's just like, what do I want to play? Okay. This is, and then all of a sudden it's like a waterfall and everything is like flooding out. It's like, I got to get out. And then boom, my character is done and set at the session right there.
Yeah. Pat seems more analytical.
I've seen him make a character where it's just like, okay, he rolls the attributes and the pixie equipment does the mechanical parts of it. And you're like, okay, I'm going to think about this. And then
that's from my character background. Like, I'll know what class I want to play.
Oh, yeah, I'm not talking about class.
The character as far as the personality.
Yeah, the personality and the background.
You develop it in-game.
Yep.
Yeah. So, John, I'm looking at the second edition reincarnate chart, and yeah, your chances of coming back as a humanoid are pretty slim.
Okay, it was not that one. It was badgers. It was the most current one.
Bears.
Baleen whales.
Centaurs, eagles, foxes, satyrs, lynxes.
We had a gay centaur in our last game.
Pixies, raccoons. Yes,
I did the one, whatever the table is, where like you were hoping and praying that you roll a bugbear because bugbear mods are just stupid good.
Yeah, you're ugly.
You're not going to be the belle of the ball anymore, but
you're going
to. They won't have any time to laugh after you punch them with your 20 strength.
This is true.
I miss Gnarl.
Yes.
But yeah, my point is being that. Just chill out. You can use that character again if you're really that sad about it. Who cares if a GM kills you off? It makes it more fun.
You know, with this topic, I mean, certainly I think there is some actionable advice, but I think more than anything, it's just kind of something to put out there in the gaming gestalt that, I mean, when John posted it, I had never really thought about it, but the minute he posted it, it didn't take more than 3 minutes of self-reflection before I was like, yeah, he's absolutely right, that I have spent a lot of my career as a gamer and a lot of my time on this podcast stressing out about something that really isn't happening. I mean, I'm sure there's groups out there where this is an issue.
I have told you repeatedly on the show, you had one really bad group and they abused you and now you're the battered spouse.
Aww. There's groups for that.
They're called
good gaming groups.
Well, that may entirely be true, but character death, that was one of our things.
Right.
They were pretty anti-character death.
Yeah.
That I really do think it was just something more that you kind of come in with this preconception of that's how it's been in the past, that it was this real competitive simulation sort of thing.
Yeah.
And we kind of have clung to that, even though that's really not the way that... I mean, not that I have any survey data in front of me, but screw the boot. It's correct. Yeah. But exactly.
We're observers and perhaps to some extent determiners of the gaming culture. And the gaming culture is you're an asshole if you kill players to such an extent that we forget that you're an asshole if you never challenge them.
Right. Yeah. And on top of that, the only that we wrong, spend a lot of time stressing about a boogeyman that really isn't there.
I think the only wrong way of doing it as a game master, it's not killing characters, and it's not killing characters. The wrong way to do it is just deciding by fiat. This character is dead. He's annoying me. He's too powerful. Rocks fall.
You're talking about encounter balance.
But how many times have you ran into that?
Right. Not many. It has happened to me. Not many.
I've never ran into it. But I've seen it happen to you.
Yeah. You were there for that game. But yeah, it's by talking about encounter balance. And this is where my view of encounter balance, especially in traditional D&D Pathfinder types games, is going to stray from, I think, the more standard way of looking at this, which is typically, what was the exact ratio they gave starting in 3.0? Wasn't it something like a given encounter should exhaust roughly
20%?
Yeah,
I think it's like 20%.
It's 20 or 25%.
It's based on the session. In a session, you'd have, if you have five encounters, you should expend about 20% of your forces.
Five encounters in one session.
Well, yeah.
And it's meant to be quick.
Well, it was a dungeon grind. It wasn't what it is today.
It's more of a dungeon crawl.
But here's the point.
Five rooms.
In my mind, that's not the encounter balance I'm looking for.
That's not the game I'm looking for.
No, but I don't say this was a poorly balanced encounter because it took 33 or 50% of my resources. I look at more as, to me, it was a fair encounter if I had a plausible chance at success, not guaranteed success, but it was at least I had a 30, 40, 50% chance of surviving the encounter. You know, I only start to get freaked about game balance if there's a fight where I feel like I didn't have sufficient information going into it to realize how out of balance it was, that what I just kicked is actually a dragon in human form. And now all of a sudden I'm a first level character facing some 20 hit die monster. And it's just like, there's no freaking way, you know, I'm just,
except through role play.
Well, assuming the game master allows that, you know, I understand you would. I totally believe that in the average game, if I did something like that, there would be a role playing out for it.
Absolutely.
Well, but not all game masters would. And you remember those Ravenloft games?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we played in games where you make choices out of ignorance and you're dead.
But you said Ravenloft. You're talking about the Ravenloft module, which is another one like...
Oh, no. This was a Ravenloft campaign.
Oh, it was
setting.
A campaign. Oh, okay.
Yeah, but still, it's a pretty grim, dark setting.
Like Tomb of Wars.
This was full gonzo, man.
Okay. But see, you're talking about this, and what I've been thinking about the whole time is that from a GM's perspective, I would hope that you want your characters to be challenged but succeed, because if they don't, then the story is over and you don't get to tell your story. Like if you get in a situation where your characters are stupid and they just walk into a dragon boss fight at first level,
wouldn't you find a way to get rid of that?
What are you going to do? Are you going to TPK and then, okay, that was great? What are you going to do? Hopefully that's not going to happen, but say it's not quite so extreme.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're going along, you're midway through a campaign. Your characters get into a fight that by rights, by design, by encounter design should be challenging yet doable. Mm-hmm. And it just goes wrong. And it's going so wrong that this is going to end in total failure. And the failure is going to be, well, it would be probably that they'll just all die. And then that would be the end of the game. So it's like, what do you do in that situation? And it's like, I've heard from John. It's like, John was saying, if you don't do it, then you're sort of pussing out and you're not going to you're not going to challenge them at all. But I say, I disagree.
Don't want the game to end.
You still have a story
you want to tell.
I'm
not.
So what do you do? What are you going to do in that situation?
Beat by a level 20 dragon at level 1.
No, that's not.
That was my extreme.
That's not what Pat's saying.
That was my extreme.
Pat's saying, what if you have what is widely considered a balanced combat encounter and suddenly everyone starts rolling like Wayne for the night.
Yeah.
Ones, 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 and then the laws of probability are just against you, and the game master is 20, 20, 20, quick, crit, crit, crit.
I think in that instance, I would pull punches.
The negative consequence of whatever that combat was happens. If it's TPK, it's TPK.
Well,
them's the titties. My combats are scary.
That's fine, but what you've done there, though, if it's a TPK,
then
the story's done. I mean, and you were halfway through a story or halfway through a campaign.
Don't pussy out, Pat. Don't pussy out.
No, they all come back as bugbears.
Usually the story is not summarily over because you've lost one combat. It can be, but it's usually not.
But so you would pull your punches in a different way, is what you're saying. So like maybe instead of killing them all off, they all go to prison. Or I mean, isn't that acceptable?
And if that is, but see, to me, in the context of what we're talking about in this episode,
yeah,
the party fails and you send them to prison. To me, that's just that is equivalent to what John's saying of pussying out. Because by rights, if this is a murderous encounter that you're up against, why are they going to, when you're knocked out, they're not going to slit your throat?
Oh, no, absolutely. If you're fighting the Tarrasque, you're not going to jail. You are going to die and the campaign is over. And I'm okay with that. If you're not fighting the Tarrasque, you might lose the fight but still live.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess I'm, in that, for instance, I would pull my punches. If it was like two characters, I wouldn't. You know, if it was just one or two.
Right. If it's
that's cheating.
A character death is different. Cheating. And that, you know, you're that is a distinction that's kind of made hard to make. But
rules.
It's like I would want to pull the punches a little bit just so the party's able to survive and
that's
continue
weakness.
On. Because I know that as a player, I would feel cheated to end that story there and not see the rest of what John had planned for us just because we f***ed up in a combat. It was that bad that we're just all dead. And it's like, what the f*** happened? Story's not, we failed. You know, we didn't go on to be able to do our thing. And we had the ultimate failure. We're dead.
The true failure.
I would just be sad because I like John's games and I want to see how they end.
I probably would be sad too, but I would be willing to have that setback, even if it did terminate a single line of campaign or a single arc, in order to maintain the credibility of my other games, which have that sort of, yes, I'm going to let you fail if you fail.
That's an interesting perspective. And I'm not condemning it or condoning it. I need to chew on that one. That's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, if credibility.
To run games a certain way, not for the sake of that game, but for the sake of the trend of games that you run. Because, you know, actually looping this around back to Mortargate, what happened with Mortargate was one game at the metagame level created a false impression of the second game, which I certainly accept some degree of responsibility for.
You accept full responsibility.
No.
Judgment.
But the point John's raising is kind of an interesting one of even if one game goes sideways, is it worth saying, hey, we need that? So there's credibility in future games, but conversely,
here's my problem with it.
Well, conversely, though, let me make one point here. But conversely, someone like Pat could say, well, you TPK'd me in that game. So that becomes the negative carryover. Now in the next game, I'm coming in more paranoid, making a slightly less deep character, whatever, because I'm afraid that you're just going to TPK me when I wasn't doing anything overtly stupid. Mm. And so, I mean, in a way that could also negatively influence the campaign tradition. And so I got to chew on this one. I don't have an immediate opinion on it.
Here's my problem with it. It's a game. I don't take it this seriously. I play to have fun.
Get out.
I know, right? the integrity of the long-term game mastery reputation. Who cares?
It's going to be
a game.
No, listen, Chad. Here it is.
Okay, lay it
on
me.
I play to have fun, too. But
I'm not saying you don't.
If I've discovered that the walls are all made of foam and the bad guy's swords are all padded, my fun is dead. So I'm really acting to preserve the fun that I perceive that I provide to other people and I experience.
Maybe you're taking it too seriously. Maybe.
No, I see what John
I'm not taking it seriously at all. This is elf pretend bullshit.
Right. I mean, I can't imagine if John was going all Black Leaf. I would have to think he'd actually be on the reverse camp of I don't want any harm to come to my characters.
Yeah. No, so, I die all the time, and I love it.
Yeah, so I get what he's saying. I mean, now, certainly, is that the way that I would want to play my games? I don't know. Like, so I got to chew on this one, because he's got an interesting thought here of how one campaign informs another. I hadn't really thought of it at that level until this episode, so I need time to think on that.
I try
one.
And run different flavors of campaigns when I run campaigns.
No, and that's perfectly viable as well, but, you know, that still creates kind of
It creates a
metagame understanding of a Chad mm-hmm. game
that you
Chad's
never know
going
what you're
to be experimenting
get.
With something mm-hmm. in this game. And that's something you've
His
said yourself.
Sexuality.
Many, yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. But no, that's something you said yourself many times that you're big on is mm-hmm. when you come into a campaign, you have a particular theme you're trying to explore. Mm-hmm. And I know that coming into a Chad game, there's a theme you're going for. And for this game to be healthy, I need to make a character that is useful in exploring mm-hmm. that theme. And when that theme comes up, I need to not do everything in my power to get away from that theme and to change the mm-hmm. plot to be about something completely different. And so that does still inform how I approach your games. So, I mean, as I keep saying, I don't have an opinion just yet, but it is an interesting idea I hadn't contemplated. You know, and I know certainly John is, he takes more joy in the challenge because of the fact that his losses validate his victories. And I get that. I don't know that I quite agree with it to the extreme that he feels that way, or at least what to me feels like an extreme, because that's not how I feel. And that's, of course, how we judge the world. We're correct, and everyone else is a deviation from correct.
No, no, I perfectly accept the fact that I'm an outlier in that I run games where my players die when they don't want to.
Right. But I can see it. I can empathize with it.
Yeah, that's right. His players die when they don't want to.
Yes, my players die, not my characters. I physically kill them.
How do you like those Doritos, Chad? And I'm like, oh, they're great.
That's right. Then you get hard herpes.
Yeah.
Dirty game.
Well, I mean, that's what happened to Julia. She played a game with you, and she only got out with hard herpes.
And the scary part was,
hey,
it was
because
she quit like halfway through one arc and never came back.
John was like, hey, Julia, make a save against myocarditis. My character? No. Oh, no.
No.
You might want to call a doctor.
Welcome to the hospital.
All right. Well, without beating this one completely to death.
Judgment.
It's given me something to think about. And I am curious, as always, to hear what
you must carry out your sentence.
I am curious to hear what you guys listening think on this and how this figures into your gaming experience. I'm certainly glad to have Julia and John back. And Julia, I hope your heart aids gets better and we can see more of you. And John, right now you're jet setting all around the country doing these law things. But hopefully you'll keep finding places that have good internet and or come back to roost in good old St. Louis here at some point where we can
show up.
We can have you behind the mics. So anyway, as for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in. Don't forget, we're still running the charity for the American Heart Association for Christmas.
Could save Julia's life.
Could save my
That's
life.
True. This has come home to roost. This has come home to roost. That $10 you donate could be the $10 that makes the difference in a grant being issued to cure
heart herpes.
I was going to say like Julianton's disease or something.
Maybe they'll find
that's
a name
when you
for
know
heart
you've
herpes.
Made it. When, yeah. When you have a disease, so
a disease
after you.
Named yeah. after you, yeah. right?
And you
actually
don't want
you
that
don't,
you're the guy
by that point you're dead.
Exactly. Because
yeah,
you're
sucks.
The guy they didn't cure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just ask Lou Gehrig.
Yeah.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Lou Gehrig or Parkinson or Huntington or any of them. Well, I don't know. Some cases,
or AIDSington, or Ebolington, or Bob AIDS,
Herpaderp,
Herpaderpies. So,
Herpaderpies is the worst kind.
Derpies, that's great. I've got derpies.
It's the lab.
You're all awful people.
I have derpy simple X.
You know, it was great about this episode is that people will not be offended or up in arms at all about the whole derpies comment. I'm waiting to just get f-ing schooled by the guys who come on here and say, no, it's not 20% of your resources. It's actually 25. It's for four encounters. Yeah, because I know that's going to happen.
Four counters doesn't take that long to play in 3-5.
Yeah.
Yeah, it takes 8.5 hours.
That's exactly what they're saying. You have the percentage wrong.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, it's going to be great.
Wow. The hell happened there? We went through puberty. So, yeah, thank you guys for tuning in.
You're the other one just dropped.
Oh. And we will catch you next time.
Herpaderpes.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2014. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.